This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. In the warm, hopeful spring of 2011, young people poured into the streets of Syria to demand democratic reforms and the release of political prisoners. But Bashar al-Assad responded by sending tanks to meet them. Rebel groups of many different political and religious persuasions joined the fight. Now, 4 years later, the civil war in Syria has cost the lives of 250,000 people, displaced 8 million civilians internally, and caused another 4 million to flee. But only when the refugees began to wash up on the shores of Europe this past summer did many people rouse themselves to ask, how? How could this happen? It is not just Syria. It is also Yemen, South Sudan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, or the Ukraine. The historian Will Durant has estimated that in all of human history, there have been only 29 years when there wasn't a war going on somewhere in the world. War is not an aberration of human experience. War is human experience. But if politicians wage wars and soldiers fight in them, it is to writers that we turn in order to understand them. The novelist Aminata Forna has devoted her considerable talents and immense intelligence to exploring the subject of war, not in the battlefield, but in the lives of civilians affected by conflict, whether in the immediate moment or many years later. In her work, she asks us to consider the physical injuries of war, as well as its moral injuries. She reveals how war changes people, how it brings with it ambiguity, where before there had been certainty, how it forces to the surface questions of responsibility, where before there had been ignorance and innocence. And above all, Forna shows us, war demands that people remember when we would much rather forget. Aminata Forna was born in Scotland, raised in Sierra Leone, and spent parts of her childhood in Iran, Thailand, and Zambia. Her first book, The Devil That Danced on the Water, is a memoir about her family's life in Sierra Leone, where her father was kidnapped by the state secret police and later executed because he dared to stand up to the tyranny of Shaka Stevens. As she tries to uncover what happened to him, she also traces the chain of events that took the country from relative peace to open war. The implosion of Sierra Leone is also the subject of Forna's first novel, Ancestor Stones, which follows a young woman as she returns home from London to take over her family's coffee plantation. Her aunts Asana, Mary, Hawa, and Sarah each tell her about their lives, beginning in the pre-colonial era all the way to independence. Through their stories, we see how the seeds of the conflict were planted many years ago and how the trauma that comes with war affects their ordinary lives. Late in the novel, Aunt Asana, who has survived patriarchal rule, colonial disruption, civil conflict, and two husbands, says, quote, "Have you ever wondered what it is that makes people do terrible things? I have. Those men and women out there were not so different from me, only something inside them had been unleashed. Where does it come from, the fury? 1,000 indignities, 1,000 wrongs, like tiny knife wounds, shredding a person's humanity. In time, only the tattered remnants are left. And in the end, they ask themselves, what good is this to me? And they throw the last of it away." What I find remarkable in Forna's work is that despite her concern with war, or perhaps because of it, her sentences pulse with life, with love, with joy. She notices the splendor of a garden of Harmattan lilies, magnificent, multi-hued, every shade of a dying sun, or how a man closes his fingers around the warmth of a woman's hand, all the while wondering what it might be like to feel that touch every day, on an arm, on the back of your neck, on your cheek. That man is Elias Cole, a university lecturer in history who faces a choice: stand up to the authorities or hand them notes on his colleague Julius Kamara, a dissident. Elias tells himself that he has done nothing wrong. Julius was already under arrest, and the notes merely confirm well-established facts. In her novel, The Memory of Love, Forna explores the consequences of doing nothing. What happens to men like Elias Cole, she asks, when they have survived the war and must live with the memory of what they have not done? In her most recent novel, The Hired Man, Forna returns to the subject of war, this time in its ethnic dimensions. How does sectarianism take root? How do people who once lived side by side suddenly turn on each other? The novel is set in Gost, a fictional village in Croatia. Juro, a middle-aged handyman, starts working for Laura, a British woman who just bought a house he knows quite well. Laura falls in love with the quaint beauty of the village, but where she sees only fields of flowers, Duro remembers the landmines buried underneath during the Civil War. Where Laura marvels at the presence of only one bakery in town, Duro remembers what happened to the other one, the one where the word for bread wasn't the Croatian kruh, but the Serbian hleb. And as Duro remembers, he also questions. He recalls one morning in particular when he went out on a hunt and came across a group of soldiers wearing the same uniforms as the men who killed his father and sister. Quote, they start off being sickened by it, slowly become inured, and then bored, the resentment begins. They look through the field scope and decide who to kill today, a man on a scooter, a couple leaving a cafe, a young woman carrying a sandwich to her father. War has inspired and intrigued many writers, but few of them have Forna's talent for rendering its moral complexities. Her imaginative empathy, coupled with her unstinting honesty, show us what war can do to others and to us. In her characters, a British doctor, a Croatian handyman, a Sierra Leonean professor, we see ourselves. For her work, Forna has won many, many prizes, including the Hurston Wright Legacy Award, the Liberatur Prize, the Commonwealth Writers Prize, and most recently, the Wyndham Campbell Prize. We're very fortunate to have her here with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome the brilliant Aminata Forna.
Thank you very much indeed. How welcome you make me feel. And what a lovely town Santa Fe is too. I've never been here before, or even to this part of the country. Makes me feel like setting a novel here, actually. When people ask me, I say it's entirely opportunism. I just had to do several months of research in Santa Fe. That was a lovely introduction. Thank you very much, Leila. I was really propelled into writing. People often ask, journalists often ask, do you know when you wanted to be a writer? And they expect us to say yes when I was four or something. I knew that I liked stories, and I was a very curious child. Mostly I was a very curious child. And I was really... But I was a child... I wasn't a bookworm. I didn't spend all my time reading. I did read, but I didn't spend all my time reading. I actually spent most of my time exploring and trying to find things out. At school, I played around with creative writing. I had an idea that I would like to be a novelist. I told my careers mistress, who said it was a terrible idea. And then she said, well, why don't you become... I was doing French and Spanish at higher level, and she said, why don't you become a translator? And I said, oh. I said, I rather thought I would write the things that were translated. And she said, I have never met a young woman with such arrogance in all my life. But she does come to my readings now, so... Much is forgiven. I was really, I was propelled into writing, and mine was a fairly slow progress. I became a journalist. I worked for the BBC for 10 years. I became frustrated as a journalist, really, that we were not addressing the stories, some of the stories, sometimes stories that I felt needed to be addressed, or not addressing them in the way that I felt told the truth of the story. And then, of course, while I was a journalist at the BBC, my own country, one of my countries, because my mother is Scottish, but Sierra Leone, my father's country, was propelled into the news. And I was actually working as a journalist when Sierra Leone was imploding. And it was a very, very strange experience to watch this happen to your country and watch it unfold on the news and watch it from afar. I wasn't a foreign correspondent, but most of the foreign correspondents came to me for advice before they went. It was a horrifying experience. It was a deeply disturbing experience. And it was also a really frustrating experience as a journalist to see how the war was described, to know what I knew about the country, and then see the events there so scantily described, really, by the news, who tended to report other wars in a great deal more detail and with a great deal more care. It seemed like when it came to an African war, it was here we go again. So I was really propelled into writing. I started with a memoir, The Devil That Danced on the Water. It was a memoir of my father, who'd been a political prisoner when I was a child, a pro-democracy activist. He'd served several sentences. He was an amnesty prisoner of conscience. And when I was 11, he was executed. But before he died, he wrote a long letter to the nation about what would happen to Sierra Leone if we continued down the path that we had. And that letter was actually hidden for 25 years by the man he gave it to just before his execution. And it was only at the end of the war that the letter was published, and it was actually the first time that my family had seen it. It was the widow of this man passed it to a newspaper, and the newspaper published it, and that was the first we'd ever seen. And he gave this very clear warning that here would come the end of the rule of law, and with it, civil war. The end of the rule of law, sorry, and with it, civil war. And that was in 1975. And all of that had come to pass. And I was so, we all had to ask ourselves the question in this country, if somebody saw it then, how did we not see it? Right? If somebody else saw it, how did the country not see it? And I wrote... I'd already actually begun work on a memoir of my father, but with the publication of this letter, I really saw that this was a story about how a country implodes. And it had happened in lots of post-colonial African countries. And, you know, now, of course, we have the experience of Iraq and Afghanistan. It seems to be a lesson we have to keep learning. But I think the whole country really wanted to know, how did we come to this? And so The Devil That Danced on the Water was really an answer to that, the progression, the incremental steps that a country, once a country has left the path, how far it goes and what each step is that takes it in that direction. At some point, and, you know, I'm not sure, sometimes I forget the order of things, but I moved to fiction after The Devil That Danced on the Water, and perhaps at some point in that transition, I came across the words of Nadine Gordimer, who said, non-fiction uncovers the lies, but only fiction can tell the real truth. And I, around that time, was beginning to realize that, you know, really, only fiction was going to bear witness, which actually was another thing that Gordimer talked about, but I didn't read these words till much later. She talked about the obligation on the part of writers of fiction in particular, to bear witness, as she and her generation of anti-apartheid writers had done in South Africa, the obligation to use our imaginations to try to seek a deeper truth after the journalists and after those immediate witnesses to an event. And so I did turn to fiction. And one of the things I really noticed when I wrote The Devil That Danced on the Water, you know, here's a small example. I wrote a chronology of the country's history. And I wrote a chronology of my father's life and I wrote a chronology of my life from 0 to 11. And then I was just trying to find the structure of the book. And then suddenly I looked at all three chronologies and I put them one on top of the other. And I saw that everything that had happened in my father's life had been dictated by what was happening in the country. And everything that had happened in my life had been dictated by what was happening in my father's life. And I became very fascinated by big P politics and the way they reverberate into an individual, onto an individual's life. And I think sometimes if you live in a small country in Sierra Leone where dramatic things have happened in a short space of time, you can really see that. You are able to see it, perhaps, not always, but in larger, more complex societies, it's hard to see how big P politics affect our lives at an everyday level. I wrote Ancestor Stones, which was my first novel, and it's in four voices, four women, elderly women. They're all the daughters of the same man, but different mothers. And they're all born into different eras of the country's history. One in the pre-colonial era, when the old ways ruled. One in the era of the missionaries. One in the colonial era. And then the last, Sarah, who was very much like my parents. She was what is called a Renaissance member of the Renaissance generation, and the Renaissance generation were those who came of age at the same time as their countries gained independence. Barack Obama's father, another one. In fact, both our fathers were part of the scholarship programs that young men and women who were to be that gen, who were that generation, and who were to lead their countries to new horizons were sent on in Britain and America. So Sarah is a member of the Renaissance generation. She becomes more directly involved in politics than either of her three sisters. I was told that, everyone likes to ask writers, where do we get our ideas from? And do you know Harrods, the great big store in Britain? A friend of mine always says that there's a place on the sixth floor of Harrods that she goes to get her ideas. I do sometimes remember where they came from, and with this particular story, which I call Red Shoes, because Sarah was very keen on a pair of red shoes, and she'd fallen in love with a young man, and he was a political activist, but she's not at this point particularly political. She just is interested in, being near him and doing the things he does. But the story actually came from a little anecdote I was told as an aside. And somebody said that they remembered the first elections in Sierra Leone in 1961. May have been 63, the first elections were, because 61 was independence. But they remembered the first elections. And nobody really had never done this before. Nobody had ever done this before. Nobody had been through the vote before. It was sort of assumed everybody knew what they were doing, but they didn't know what they were doing. And a young woman was given a job as a returning officer, and nobody turned up. And she thought she was going to get into trouble because she didn't have any papers in her ballot, in her ballot box. Here's Sarah's story. Another day, Janna asked me if I wanted to be a returning officer. I was so flattered, I said yes, straight away, with no idea what I was being asked to do. My post was a rice-weighing station in a town I'd never been to before. I was given a seat behind a desk, upon which were heaped piles of voting papers and a long list of names. At my feet, a metal ballot box. Two more boxes, wooden this time, were placed at one end of the room next to each other. A thin curtain suspended on a wire hung between them. The officer in charge gave me the key to the metal box and said he would be back to collect it at the end of the day. Polling started at 7:30 sharp. I pushed at the door of the station, which was really a shed, and the sunlight streamed in, lighting up the rice dust suspended in the air. I picked up a pile of papers and stood there in readiness. An hour later, I went back to the desk and sat down on the chair. I straightened the papers, arranging them into two neat stacks. the list of names and the pen I placed in front of me. I strolled back to the door and looked out. Two men were coming down the lane. I hurried back to the desk. I watched them as they strolled past the open door without turning once. I got up and stared down the road after them. Outside the station, posters fluttered faintly in the breeze. It had rained in the night. Damp patches of ground steamed gently in the sun. The leaves on the trees shone bright as jewels. Tiny black midges danced across the puddles. A man with a rolled umbrella appeared before me. I stepped aside. "Are you here to vote?" "How much for one bushel?" I smiled. I explained who I was. I was the returning officer for the elections. The Rice Station would be operating again tomorrow. In the meantime, he could come in and vote. "Now?" he asked. "Today. The elections are being held today to decide who should head the government." I gestured with my hand towards the polling booth. The man hesitated and then stepped inside. I continued. "What's your name? I have to mark it on the list to say you've voted." The man told me his name. "Abu." "Abu?" "Yes." "Abu what? What's your father's name?" "Abu Kamara." I traced my finger down the list. There were a lot of Kamaras, dozens in fact. Oddly, no Abu. I checked. "Abu, yes." "Do you have another name that you use? A middle name?" He said he did not. "Alfred Kamara? Al-Hajji Kamara. Maybe this man had been to Mecca." "Are you a Muslim?" "I am a Muslim." That seemed to be good enough. He had a vote, I just couldn't find it. I did not want to disappoint him or lose my first client. I placed a tick next to the name Al-Hajji Kamara and handed him a voting form. I told him to go into the booth and select his candidate, and then to press his thumb into the purple ink pad to sign, and again onto the bottom of the form, unless, that is, he knew how to write his name. He had one question. "Who is it I'm voting for?" "You vote for the candidate of your choice." "What is his name?" "Your choice is your own, I can't tell you that." The man stood and gazed at the paper in his hand. He moved neither forward nor back. "So who did you vote for?" he asked. "I hadn't voted. I hadn't thought about it. Suleiman Bio, the People's Choice. I cited the campaign literature. People's Progress Party." "The People's Choice?" I smiled, nodding, said it again. "The People's Choice? The choice of the people." That way round, it sounded like a foregone conclusion. The man moved towards the booth. "Third one down," I added, to be helpful. Minutes later, he departed with a purple thumb and a purple stamp on the back of his hand to stop him from trying to vote again. Later in the afternoon, I kicked off my red shoes and rubbed the soles of my feet. From time to time, I went to the door to try to encourage passers-by, such as there were, to come inside. Still, no one came. I went back to the desk and gazed idly at the list of names. I felt like a hostess who'd been snubbed by her guests. I let my eyes run down the names. Name upon name. Like ladder rungs. Railway track sleepers. Or a row of sleeping children. Players waiting to be picked for a team. First, I stole Jennifer Turay's vote. I took it as my own. I reckoned by now she wasn't coming, whoever she was. Since I hadn't voted anywhere else, I didn't see how it could possibly matter. I pressed my right thumb into the ink pad and then onto the bottom left of the voting slip. With an hour to go before the election was over, two votes lay in the cavern of the ballot box, like visitors in an empty church. So I spent the remainder of the time filling it up, creating signatures and using up the fingers of one hand and then the other, and finally each of my toes to create fictional thumbprints. At 6 o'clock, I closed the door and waited for the box to be collected. I kept my inky hands folded behind my back while the men heaved it into the back of the van along with the others. Sometime when during the period when I was writing the ancestor stones, or even before I'd begun it. I think I may even have still been working on The Devil That Danced on the Water, but I was in conversation about The Devil That Danced on the Water with a friend of mine from Argentina. And it is sometimes a surprise to people to hear that for quite a while I considered a novel with a character not called Elias Cole, called something different, but with a main character who was a man who had failed to act at a crucial time in his country's history. But in fact, that the country that I was planning to set it in was Argentina and not Sierra Leone at all. And what happened was this. I was talking to a friend of mine from Argentina, and she was talking to me about her father. Well, I was talking about my father, and The Devil That Danced on the Water. And she told me about growing up during the Dirty War in Argentina and how she was too young to really know what was happening. But at a certain point later in life, she began to ask herself the question, and she thought that the same question was being asked by her sisters and brothers as well. They were all asking the same question, and the question was this. You see, their father was a leading intellectual. The question was this. In a country where everybody who stood up against the terrible atrocities and disappearances and murders that were happening suffered the same fate, at the very least, they lost their job. Or they didn't get promoted. Or they lost their job. Or they had to leave the country. Or they served a prison sentence. And at the very worst, they were murdered or disappeared, and nobody knew what their fate was. And that was the fate of a good many people around her and people who were at the university that her father taught at. And she said at one point there came to her, when she was a young woman, the question, because none of this had happened to her father, who had gone on to have a very successful career as an academic. She said, there comes a time when you have to ask the question. And the question is, how can it be? How can it be? And, you know, I think of The Devil That Danced on the Water and The Memory of Love as being the fictional and non-fiction counterparts to each other. And this is what I mean by fiction can answer questions that non-fiction can't. I could never, if I tried to, however open people were being with me at the end of the war when I wrote The Devil That Danced on the Water, I could never have really got to the bottom of what the stories were, those people who didn't act when they could have acted. What were the stories they were telling themselves to make it all right? Because I suspect that they didn't know. You know, they hadn't interrogated their own action and inaction. And only fiction could really take us into the world and into the mind of a person like Elias Cole and walk the walk with him and see how those decisions are made and make us ask the question of what would we have done at particular times? Would we have become Elias Coles or would we have become something else? The story is Elias Cole's story, and he tells his story to a young British psychologist called Adrian Lockhart, who in fact does appear in Ancestor Stones, if anyone reads it. I suddenly had the idea of taking him out of that book and putting him in this one, because I'd been somewhat unkind to him in the previous book. I thought that I'd give him another chance to try and get it right. But also I wanted Adrian Lockhart to be the reader, to listen to this man and, you know, in a country he doesn't know and has never been to and try to figure out, in a country where everybody is silent, they are silent because of they have endured 30 years of oppression when they could not talk about what was going on. They are silent because they are traumatized. Right? In a country with so much silence, why is there one person who wants to tell his story? I'm going to read a short piece from it. This is where Adrian meets the man who will become his friend and guide through the time he spends in Sierra Leone, a young surgeon called Kai Mansaray. Kai has turned up. Adrian sleeps in a flat in the hospital to which he's seconded, and Kai has turned up in the middle of the night and asked if he can sleep on the sofa, which is something he apparently used to do when the flat was empty. In this country, there is no dawn, no spring or autumn. Nature is an abrupt timekeeper. About daybreak, there is nothing in the least ambiguous. It is dark or it is light, with barely a sliver in between. Adrian wakes to the light. The air is heavy and carries the faint odour of mould, like a cricket pavilion entered for the first time in the season. It is always there, stronger in the morning and on some days more than others. It pervades everything. The bedsheets, towels, his clothes, dust and mould. Outside his window, somebody is talking in a loud voice. He has no idea what they're saying. For a moment, his mind drifts with the thought, to be surrounded by languages you don't understand, of how it must, in some ways, be like being deaf. The deaf children he knew, whose parents sometimes came to see him, became remote, cut off, even inside their own families. Silent islands. By the time they were diagnosed, the damage to the relationship with their parents and siblings was already done. No wonder, he thinks, that the deaf create their own communities, turning their backs on the hearing world. In the kitchen, Kai Mansouray, barefoot but dressed in the clothes of the night before, is opening and closing cupboard doors. He doesn't turn when Adrian greets him. "Hey, man, not much in here. Tell me you have coffee." Adrian opens a cupboard on the opposite wall and finds the tin of instant coffee. He fills the kettle with water from the plastic bottle and lights the gas ring. Kai Mansouray watches him. "Boiling sterilizes it." "I know," says Adrian, feeling the other's gaze. He fetches down the only two mugs he possesses and prizes the lid of the coffee tin open with the end of a teaspoon. "How did you find the couch? I hope it was all right." "Fine, fine. Me and your couch, we go back a long time." "I'm not a big sleeper anyhow. I had to check on my patient." "How is she doing?" When there is no reply, Adrian glances up. Kai Mansouray is studying the label on the coffee tin. Adrian can't be sure whether he heard the question or not. Suddenly the other man looks up at him. "I could eat," he announces. "I'll make us breakfast." "Well, there's nothing much here." "You don't say." For the first time since they met, Kai Mansouray smiles. "You relax." He steps around Adrian so nimbly Adrian doesn't have time to move out of the way, opens the door of the apartment. "Shh, I say, come." He beckons. A hospital porter hurries over. Kai hands him a few coins, and a short time later, the porter reappears carrying a plastic bag and two freshly baked loaves of bread wrapped in newspaper. Adrian dresses to the sounds of his visitor, preparing breakfast in the kitchen. Efficient sounds that relay a deftness of hand, a certainty of procedure. Still, he dresses quickly. By the time Adrian reappears, the apartment has been overtaken by the smell of frying onions. In the kitchen, Kai Mansouray breaks with one hand eggs into a soup bowl and whisks them into a froth. He has made coffee in the teapot and replaced the broken lid with the saucer. Adrian pours two cups and sets one where the visitor can reach it, then leans back on the counter. In the silence, a prickle of self-consciousness touches him. He shifts from one foot to the other. Watching the newcomer move around the kitchen, his kitchen, as though he were a man entirely alone in his own space, it is Adrian who feels like the intruder. He has yet to become used to it, the silences between people. In Britain, people came or were sent to see him. He learnt to examine their silence to see if it was tinted with shame or pain or guilt, coloured with reluctance or tainted with anger. He himself used silence as a lure, pitting his own silence against theirs until they were compelled to fill the void. Here, those tricks have no place, even with those he calls his patients. If Adrian falls silent, so too do they, waiting patiently and without embarrassment. Here the silences have a different quality, are entirely devoid of expectation. And so he watches Kaimatsu Rei shaving curls of cheese with a knife blade. Swift, deft movements. Next, Kai spoons 2 teaspoons of powdered milk into a teacup, dribbles a little water from the tap into it, and mixes the powder and water into a paste. This he adds to the eggs along with the cheese, relights the gas ring beneath the frying pan, and pours the mixture into it. While the eggs cook, he divides the fruit, scooping out shiny grey-black seeds, cuts a lime in half and squeezes the juice over the orange flesh. They sit down at the table to eat. "Papaya," says Adrian, recognising the fruit. "He's never seen one so large." "Pawpaw," replies the other. "Pawpaw, is that what you call papaya?" Kai Mansur Rei turns and looks at him briefly. "That's what it is." He takes a bite. "Netherlands? I beg your pardon?" Kai Mansur Rei eats rapidly, hunched over the table, arms either side of his plate, as though ready to defend his food. "Where you're from?" He tears a hunk of bread from the loaf and points it at Adrian's chest. "I'm English," Adrian frowns. "Obvious, surely." "Okay, only we get a lot of Dutch. Medical or emergency? You're not in surgical." "Actually, neither." Adrian takes a sip of his coffee. "I'm a psychologist." The other man looks up from his food at that, raises his eyebrows, inclines his head by slowly tilting his chin to one side. "Okay." The word is spoken in 2 parts, split down the centre as neatly as if he'd used an axe, as though he is considering the statement carefully, examining its likelihood. Adrian might just have confessed to being the grand old Duke of York. "So do they make you pay for this place?" he says, changing the subject. Adrian tells him, and Kai snorts by way of response. "For how long? I mean, I take it you haven't immigrated." "I'm seconded for 1 year." "So you don't plan on coming to live here for good?" "No, well, no, I thought not. If you did, you'd be the first immigrant in 200 years. Kai Mansur Rei laughs at his own joke, a raucous, ear-splitting sound. "We don't have any tourists, even." "Except your sort, that is." "My sort?" The visitor takes another bite of bread. "Nothing. What I meant to say to you was, welcome." Having set 3 books in Sierra Leone, I felt the good people of Sierra Leone had had enough of me. I was still very interested in conflict. You know, what happened was in Sierra Leone after the war, we were all still left with each other. You know, people didn't go back to their countries. Refugees were not patriated somewhere else. We were all still with each other, and we had to figure out how to get along, even though we knew what people had done and were not done. And I had some friends, actually, from the former Yugoslavia, and we would sometimes talk about our wars, our experience of civil war, and it did strike me that it was something so particular. And one of the things we'd always ask each other is, who do you know who did what? You know. And I was drawn to write about the Croatian conflict for a couple of reasons. You know, the wars were contemporaneous. They both began in 1991. The countries are very similar size. They both have about the same size population, same size square mileage. They both are very beautiful coastal countries, exquisitely beautiful, both of them, in fact. Quite undeveloped, rural agro-economies, people still living in villages very much as they have done for hundreds of years, a tourist industry. And then, of course, crucially, they had both suffered 30 years of civil war, followed by a very sharp economic downturn. So I thought these countries were, to me, very similar, even though it was rather a surprise to at least a lot of critics that I had chosen to write, set a book in Croatia. But later on, people are so focused on, I suppose, on ethnicity and regionality. Sometimes they can't see what's quite obvious. I think my Bosnian Croatian friends and I felt we were all quite alike. We just thought the British were quite different. Actually, after I'd written the novel, I came across a wonderful thing called the Hofstede dimensions. Does anyone know what they are? Any anthropological psychologist in this room? The Hofstede dimensions are... Gert Hofstede was a Dutch cultural anthropologist, and he came across these six measures. He was six dimensions by which he measured countries, how they were on certain things, sense of community or individualism and things like that. And I came across them some time after I'd written the novel, and I thought, I'll look and see what Sierra Leone and Croatia are like, And I looked at Sierra Leone and Croatia, and although the data was incomplete for Sierra Leone, it was, we Croatian and Sierra Leone were very, very much alike. And I thought, I'll look at Britain and see whether Britain is like Sierra Leone or Croatia. And Britain was completely different. It had nothing in common with two of us whatsoever. So it seemed to me very obvious to look at another country. And I was fascinated by a couple of things. The piece I'm going to read for you now, which is going to be the last piece I'll read, I suppose a couple of things fascinated me. There were the similarities, and then there were the differences. And one of the differences was, of course, that this conflict went down ethnic lines, and the conflict in Sierra Leone, even though it was misreported as being ethnic, was never ethnic. And I think this allowed Sierra Leone to commit what I think is probably one of, along with South Africa, the greatest acts of forgiveness I've ever seen, because it was everybody. We could not other... We could not say it was them or them or them, right? It was not the Timneys or the Mendes. It was everybody. In Croatia, something else happened. We called it shamefully ethnic cleansing. And the emblem of that war, there were two emblems of that war, and one of them was the empty house. So I was really intrigued when I started to come across advertisements in British newspapers for cheap holiday homes in Croatia. I thought that was so chilling. And if I was to bring myself to buy a holiday home in Croatia after all that has happened, I would very much wish to know the provenance of that house. The second thing that I found different about the two wars was how quickly the Croatian war had come to pass. It seemed that Sierra Leone had been such a slow burn. It had taken us such a long time, to pick up arms. And in fact, really, it was the spillover from Liberia that did it. And of course, they found a tinderbox ready to go up, but it was the spillover from Liberia. Croatia, the former Yugoslavia, Slovenia, then Croatia, then Bosnia, Kosovo. I mean, it just swept through at an incredible speed. Well, I had a friend who was a war correspondent, and he was talking to me about it. And one of the things he said in passing, he said, the reason that war kicked off so fast was because they were a nation of hunters, and every single man owned a gun, and every single man knew how to use one. So on top of an already significant standing army, which Milosevic had at his disposal, he also could put together militias at an incredibly fast pace. And that couldn't be done in Sierra Leone. And then, of course, this is why that war became a sniper's war. Sarajevo, it became a sniper's war. And the emblem of, along with the empty house, was of the sniper on the hills, of people rushing past Sniper Alley. And the emblem of our war in Sierra Leone was, of course, the amputated limb, the hands and feet amputated. And then I thought to myself, I saw something I couldn't believe I hadn't seen before. I thought, what do people pick up when they go to war? Guns, yes. What if you don't have guns and you are a nation of farmers? You pick up a machete. And that was why these two wars fought with different weapons had such different visual emblems. Of course, the Bosnia-Yugoslav war was also a war of sieges. It was fought in a very medieval, along very medieval strategies. So you know a little bit about this book already. Duro is a handyman, and Laura is an English woman who's bought a house in Gost, and Duro helps her. He needs the work, he becomes a handyman. He knows a little bit about the house's history. This goes back to Duro recalling the time of war. The storm over the town rumbles day after day. Some people have already left Gost. They left before dawn and after dusk without telling their neighbours, and they left their pets behind. How did they know? The rest of us didn't see it coming. Now it's impossible to leave too many refugees. There are the roadblocks and checkpoints. Both sides are happy to shoot you. A dog or cat in the car is a sure sign you're getting out, and that means trouble. The abandoned dogs sit outside their old homes, waiting to be let in. I borrow books from the library on the days it is open. I read about sieges. Constantinople, Delhi, Mafeking, Paris, Dien Bien Phu, Leningrad. The siege of French forces by the Viet Minh in their garrison, Dien Bien Phu, took place in 1954 and lasted for exactly 54 days. In the middle of that 54th night, the Brigadier General in Dien Bien Phu radioed his commander and asked permission to surrender. "You've done magnificently. Don't spoil it now by hoisting the white flag," said his commander 300 kilometres away. "Okay," replied the besieged man from his valley hole, surrounded and overlooked by tens of thousands of enemy soldiers. "I was only thinking to save the wounded. There were 5,000 at that time, you understand." "Well, see you soon," replied the commander. French soldiers named their strong points after women: Beatrice, Gabrielle, Isabelle, Hélène. The men decided to hold off the enemy as long as possible and allow the men and Isabelle to make a run for it. They had the best chance, you see, but only 70 made it anyway, so it was for nothing. 10,000 were taken captive, forced marched to prison camps across the country. Most of them died on the way. Nobody had expected the Viet Minh to use 19th century tactics. In Dien Bien Phu, planes dropped rations and the men crept out under the barbed wire into no man's land to fetch them and were shot to bits. The citizens of Paris ate the animals in the zoo. Castor and Pollux, the elephant pair, were shot through the eyes, as nobody could lay hands at that time upon an elephant gun. Only the zoo's big cats were spared because of the difficulty of approaching them. Also the monkeys. People thought they looked too much like humans. Parisians developed a taste for horse meat, which continues, as well as dog, cat and rat meat, which does not. Photographs of Paris during the Great Siege, people sitting in restaurants with napkins tucked round their necks, munching on rat blanquette, accompanied by the last decent bottles of wine. A heavy mist slides between the trees and across the sloping ground. The tree trunks are slick and black, thick odour of rotting leaves, and mingled with the cold morning air and the sharp scent of pine, the snap of cordite. A deadly hush. I am alone. I tread with care, weight on the outside of my foot. The dampness helps, softens the ground. The heavy air smothers small sounds. The deer are nowhere to be seen, but I sense them behind the mist, smell their moist breath, see the flash of a liquid gaze, and feel a trembling footfall, twitching hide and hair, the quiver of a haunch. They are watching the shape-shifting patterns of mist. At the first tree, I pause, wait, and listen. I peer through the trees into the almost darkness. Forward, forward, step by step. Minutes pass and still no sight of the deer. They must be retreating ahead of me, herding uphill. I stop and look the way I have come. The mist is beginning to clear in patches. Here and there, shafts of sunlight reach the forest floor, freeing curls of vapour. Underfoot, the ground is soft, springy and damp. The upper tree line is several hundred metres away. I'm closer to the soldiers' camp than I have ever been, though still a good kilometre away, and the wind is in my favour. Out of nowhere, a deer barrels across my path, a young male on the edge of panic, the smell of musk and fright all about him. He's there and gone. It gives me a jolt, a squeeze to the heart. I wait a minute or two before I begin to move steadily in the direction he went. A mature doe comes racing towards me, passing within metres, fleeing some threat, or she'd never come so near. Only a few times in all my years have I been so close to a live animal. Seconds later, a group comes racing through the trees, a second group bolt past the other way. I'm caught in the middle of a stampede. There's something comic about it, the deer, their sudden leaps and graceless crashings, and when they stop, they stand around as if they're embarrassed at their own behaviour, before the madness goes to their head again and they're off, ricocheting through the trees. Something has spooked them, not me, though by now they've surely scented me, which is no doubt adding to the general confusion. I wait in the shadow of a tree. There's no point. There's no longer any point being here. Nothing can happen now. The deer's blood is up. I won't get close to the herd today. Movement. There's another animal in these woods. Smaller, nearly as fast as a deer, a softer footfall. It scatters a group of deer and lurches round in a circle before heading back towards them. A dog. A youngster of two or so with huge paws, ears streaming behind him, tongue lolling. The thrill of the chase gone to his head. He races straight past me. The deer have his eye and he's heady with the scent of them. I don't recognise him as belonging to anyone in Goth, and he doesn't look like a stray. Hunting breed. Well fed, well cared for. Totally undisciplined. The sound of voices. Singing and shouting. Soldiers singing drunken songs. A late night session has turned into an early morning hunt, but none of them is sober enough for it. The dog is out of control. This is bad for me. The big problem is the dog. At the moment, he's too bound up chasing the deer, but the minute I start to run or even move, that will change. If I stay where I am, which I don't have any choice but to do, he could still come back. I'm pretty sure he's seen me. He's just not that interested while there are deer to chase. I stand still and count my breaths. 3-4 minutes pass. I hear the hooves of the panicked deer, catch glimpses of them through the trees. The men's voices rise with the power of the song, fade and start over. There are three of them. They're singing so tuneless, it's only on the second round. I recognise the song, Hajde da Lurujemo. Last time I sang it, it was at Yabo and Anka's place after the party at the Zodiac. I think of how we all used to join in. I think about what would happen if I did so now. I smile. And then the dog comes back. This time he sees me. He's bored of deer he can't catch. He comes over. A nice dog, glossy and fit. I imagine one of them found him or stole him somewhere along the front line from one of the villages where some guy, who may be dead now for all I know, bred him and the rest of his litter. I put a hand out to him, which is what he wants, just to say hello. As long as I keep him quiet, it can still be okay. Ignoring him will only make him more interested. Anything as foolish as trying to hide would have started him barking. I stroke his muzzle and ears, in a quiet voice I tell him to sit. He sits and looks at me expectantly. I order him to lie down. He does. He waits, looking for his reward. When he figures it isn't coming, he looks around for an escape and rises slowly, hoping I won't call him back. When he thinks he's clear, he bounds away to look for his master. The singing grows fainter. There are only two of them at it. Another song. They're moving away, heading to the camp, needing to get back in time to sober up with a long day murdering civilians ahead of them. When I judge it safe enough, I move. I don't head back the way I came, but move diagonally downhill, taking advantage of the cover of the trees for as long as possible. It is later than I would like it, and there's too much light in the sky. This is a new danger. I have to get out of the woods and across no man's land without being seen. I start to jog, slowly enough to keep an eye out, faster enough to cover the ground. I'm stood in the woods when I come across him. I stop and take cover behind a tree. Standing with his legs apart and his flies undone, pissing against the tree, unsteady on his feet, he sways forward and then back, holding onto his cock as if for balance and staring at the jet of piss. This guy is one of the drunk hunters who's been left behind by his friends. Only two voices, where there had been three. My mistake. I'd assumed they were all still together, but no, here is number three, in my way, taking a leak while the sun climbs higher and higher with every second. Soon it will break the horizon. I feel a small jet of rage.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
It's quite a low chair.
Hi again. I'm so excited to be talking to you about your work, and particularly about The Hired Man, which I love, 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 love. I feel like it's fortuitous that we're having this discussion on Veterans Day. And of course, here in the States, you know, it's the one day where they celebrate soldiers who've fought in all these wars, and then the rest of the year, you know, the subject of war is avoided as much as possible. And I imagine this is the same. I imagine this is the same also in Great Britain. But you've lived in other places as well, and you've researched also Yugoslavia. And I wondered if that was the same, this sort of idea that, you know, that war is not really something to talk about.
Well, yes, of course, because in Britain we have Poppy Day, which is the same as this time, almost exactly this time of year as well. You know, I've thought about this. I think war is so hard to imagine that unless you've lived through it, you can't imagine it. And so that is the big difference between those who have in some way endured a war and also in those who have fought in a war and those who have not. So what happens is that the rest of us maintain a kind of a silence. I would really notice that, you know, talking to my friends from the former Yugoslavia, we would stop talking if a British person came in. Mm-hmm. It was almost like we were holding a secret. Mm-hmm. And men who fought in war, you know, very famously don't talk about what happened to them. Those of you who are old enough to remember the Second World War, you know, those men didn't come back and talk about their experiences. So there's always a silence around war anyway. And then I guess you add to it what governments have to do in order to make young men fight wars. And if you know, what you do is you get a professional standing army. And the times, I suppose, in this country where people became most exercised by war was when conscription happened, when men who had not elected to go to war were being asked to go. But you know, you have a standing army, a professional army, and then you create a mythology of war, and people are called heroes, and you manage it, really. Mm-hmm. So I think it's not surprising we have that silence around war, but I do feel that part of the silence is willful, which is the part that I wish to break. You know, my main character of Laura is somebody who simply doesn't want to hear about these things. She wants life the way it is and doesn't want to hear about the ugly way in which a lot of things are managed, sometimes on her behalf, or things that happen in other parts of the world.
It's interesting that you say that, because when you were talking about the silence about the war, my first thought was about Duro himself, because Duro also doesn't talk about the war, I mean, until Laura's daughter keeps asking questions. But he doesn't volunteer any information either. So I was curious, actually, about the character of Duro. Because earlier when you were talking about how you were writing the novel and the inspiration with the houses that were for sale in Croatia, is that where the idea of having a handyman for a main character came through? Because you needed the house, and then that's how... I guess what I'm asking is a process question. How did you put together this sort of character?
Well, I mean, Dura, of course, he's taciturn anyway. He's like that, to go back to your earlier point. He's
I like him.
And he's holding on to secrets, so he's silent for a reason. He's holding on to secrets. But also, which goes back to our first question, the other thing I really noticed in Sierra Leone is that people didn't talk about the war there for the very simple reason that everyone had been through it. There was not that much to talk about. Everyone had endured this awful thing, and what was left to say, really. Yeah. And so that's how I feel about Dura in Croatia. He's in this small town where things have happened. What is there left to say?
Yeah.
But the reason he's a handyman is this. I had to create a scenario. And, you know, Laura doesn't know about the things that have happened in this town. She can't read the town.
She's the stranger who comes to town and shakes it up. Uh-huh.
And I can read Sierra Leone. I know I know which elephants are in the room. I've been in situations with people who are visitors from outside, and there's an enormous elephant in the room. And we know it, but they don't know it. And so I first went to Croatia as Laura. I didn't read a great deal about it. I went as Laura tried to see if I could read this country. And, of course, I couldn't. And then I came back and did loads of research. And then I went back again where I could read it a great deal better. So I thought, here's the thing, you see. Here's the thing. In Sierra Leone, when the fighters were being decommissioned, the rebel fighters were being decommissioned, they were given a choice of occupations that they could train in. One was carpentry, I think plumbing was another one, or they could get a driving license. And an awful lot of these guys learnt to drive because it was just felt so much easier and probably cooler to become a taxi driver. So you know where I'm going with this, don't you? Right? So at the end of the war in Sierra Leone, in Freetown, if you hailed a taxi from the road as a visitor, the chances that you were hailing a taxi driven by somebody who had probably done some pretty dreadful things in the war was quite high, and this person would conduct you to the town, to your destination, without you ever knowing. So I thought, who would you open your door to in a town where you didn't know anybody, right? You'd open your door to the plumber, the carpenter, you know, the man who's going to fix the roof, that's who you would trust to open your door to. So that's how Dura gets access to the house and into Laura's life.
She's a fascinating character. I about her, Dura says, I should mention that she'd greeted me in English, and now we spoke in English. My English is imperfect. It had been a long time. I wondered what kind of assurance she possessed to speak to a stranger in a foreign land in her own tongue and expect to be understood. Clearly, she enjoyed the luck of the innocent. And also with the portion that you read earlier with Adrian, also there's a bit of that. So there's a little bit of sly criticism at these British characters that show up in Croatia and expect that other people...
Yeah, well, if you come from a country, as I do, to Scotland and Sierra Leone, that appear to matter not at all to anybody. I mean, Sierra Leone has absolutely no sort of economic or geopolitical significance whatsoever. So, you know, it's always quite fascinating how people from small nations relate to people from more powerful countries, or certainly in the case of Britain, countries that have been very powerful. And certainly Britain punches above its weight on the global stage. And that kind of filters all the way down, really, to how people behave in everyday interaction with people in other countries. And, you know, it's sort of rather a trait. But, Laura is somebody who doesn't have a great deal of imagination. And she's somebody, she can't live outside herself. You know those people? They can't imagine being somebody else. So when she meets... So this is the constraints with which Laura lives and her sort of slightly willful ignorance around the place that she finds herself. But she can't imagine what it's like to be anybody else, and so it just doesn't occur to her to do anything but use the language that she knows and assume or hope that they will respond?
Well, fortunately for her, you have that empathy, and you've created this character that for all her faults, we still have a lot of sympathy for. I had another question, too, about sort of a structural question about the book, because in the section, for example, that you read just now, where Duro is remembering what happened in the past, it's set in the present, but the house renovation, the sort of thing that happens in the now, that's written mostly in the past. Why the past and the present and the present in the past?
Well, I inverted them, so yeah. I use the present tense for memories. I learnt a lot when I was writing The Memory of Love about the nature of trauma and flashbacks and how people who are suffering very badly from post-traumatic stress disorder feel the flashbacks so immediately. And I was trying to find a way. I mean, Duro does not have PTSD, but he is dealing with uncomfortable memories that that Laura and her family are igniting in him. And so I wanted to find a way to, on paper, evoke that feeling of the suddenness of a memory rushing in, like it does when you have a troubling memory that you're trying to suppress.
No, it worked beautifully. I didn't even realize this was going on until halfway through the book, and I thought, oh my God, genius. And so can you talk also a little bit about the research that you did? Did you research everything first and then sat down to write it, or was there a lot?
Mainly I do all my research first. A lot of that reason is because I found out more about my characters when I researched them, you see. Mm-hmm. So I walk their walk and I live their lives. Kai was a surgeon. I spent quite a lot of time in the operating theatre. Adrian was a psychologist. I spent quite a lot of time in a mental institution. I haven't found a way of saying that without making it sound... I'm making it sound worrying. But... with kind people who let me in and, you know, understand what I'm doing. And it really, really informs the character. So, and also I start with character. So I started with the character of Duro. And the thing I did for the character of Duro was learn to shoot a high-velocity rifle. I learned to shoot to a very, pretty good level.
Now, well, I can tell in the book.
It's very hard to do in Britain. We don't have access. We have very, very, very tight restrictions on guns, especially guns like that. But I found a man who was a former police marksman, and he taught me how to shoot. And there was something so fascinating. I learned many, many fascinating things. To be a very good marksman, you have to be so in control of yourself. Mm-hmm. You cannot be... an excitable person. So it told me what Duro's character was like. And my instructor told me this one thing that was so extraordinary. He said that the very best Olympic marksmen, when they pull the trigger, do it between heartbeats. Mm. And they don't even know they're doing it. It's only when they measured their heartbeats and their... their trigger training that they realized this was happening.
Since we're talking about the research, maybe we can talk also a little bit, because you mentioned about the memory of love, having to spend time in mental hospitals and all of that. Was the research heavier for that book, did you feel, with the memory of love?
For the reason that I chose to cast a psychologist and a surgeon, yes, very heavy. I mean, of course, I had quite a lot of residual knowledge of Sierra Leone, but then a whole chunk was set in the 1960s and 70s, and I didn't have that. I didn't have much residual knowledge of the 60s at all. I had a little bit of the 70s, so I had to do quite a lot of research on that. I had written ancestor stones, which crossed over with that period, but it was very heavy. And I do joke, but I'm not entirely joking when I say, and I told you why Duro is a handyman, is because he can get access to the house, but it's also because I wouldn't have to do so much research. My husband is really, really, really good at building houses, and I was just able to turn around to him and go, how do you do that?
That's very convenient.
But there is one funny thing about Duro where he restores a car that's in the barn in one of the outbuildings of this house. It's called a Fico, a particular kind of Fiat that was made for Yugoslavia, very particular of the era of the 1970s. And he restores it and gives it to Laura as a gift. Now, you can imagine I know absolutely nothing about restoring cars. Well, there's no reason I should know nothing, but anyway, I'm telling you, I know absolutely nothing about restoring cars. So I thought, this car's got to get done. So I emailed a friend of mine who was a mechanic or knew a lot about cars, and I told him, here's this car, and it hasn't been driven for 25 years, you know, 20 years, what do I do? So he told me all the things, and I would keep emailing back and saying, okay, I did that, and I think it's this, it's the starter motor, it must be, because that's what you said. And, you know, we went on, and I got this car, the car goes all the way through the book, and then it gets done, and I had to keep it within the timeline. It couldn't take forever to get this car on the road. And anyway, then I carried on writing, and I finished writing, and then, in fact, the proofs were out. I suddenly got a note from him saying, well, where's the car? I had no idea. He thought there was a real car. I thought... So I didn't say anything. I put the book into an envelope. I sent him the book, and just with the sort of with love, you know. And he sent me an email back. So,
I had another question also about Memory of Love, since we've mentioned it. With Elias Cole, who's a lecturer in history, which is a great, great choice. I mentioned earlier that he feels the need to tell the story because of what he did not do. Now, what do you think was behind that? What do you think was behind Inaction? Do you think, because one of the things that I thought was really interesting in that book is that there's the character of Safiya, the love interest, and so he has at least that motive of having Julius out of the way, but there is also the fear of repercussions for himself. Why do you think he does the things that he does? Is it fear? Is it love? Is it cowardliness?
Well, I think Elias is probably trying to figure it out himself, but I think one of the things that happens is that we take quite momentous decisions for quite small reasons and don't see how momentous they are afterwards. Mm-hmm. And the reasons are very often personal. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, you know, remember I told you that the Memory of Love was nearly set in Argentina? Well, the idea for The Hired Man came from something that had happened in Sierra Leone. It was a killing during the war that turned out to be actually a personal vendetta. Mm-hmm. And I think that happened quite a lot. Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes when I think when people do... How do you get people to do terrible things at certain times? You can get them to do quite small acts for personal reasons, which is what happened in Gost. Actually, the people of Gost would not have killed their neighbours, but they did loot their houses, and then they became complicit in something greater, so that when their neighbours started... When greater atrocities were wreaked upon their neighbours, the village was already complicit. And, you know, those things that they did, the stealing of items from the houses, were small, petty little acts of jealousy and envy. Mm-hmm. And that's what motivates Elias Cole. He's actually motivated by quite a small act. He's jealous of Julius. He's desperately, desperately jealous of Julius.
Yeah.
And he's not a brave man. He's a coward. Mm-hmm. So he does what he does. And I mean, in fact, well, he doesn't. He fails to do something. But then, you know, the line keeps tipping, and there comes a point where Elias is on the road to no return.
Mm-hmm. And in that book, you also have two other really interesting characters. Kai, that you read a piece about, who's a surgeon, and Adrian, who's the psychologist. What drew you to write about the war from the perspective of doctors? I mean, did you have... was it because you were interested in PTSD? Because here, when we talk about PTSD in the U.S., in any case, we talk about soldiers. But in this case, in the Memory of Love, the traumatic events that people have gone through, those are civilians, and
well,
they're dealing
with... Well, that's the key, really, yeah. Is that I write about civilians at war. None of my books deal with soldiers at war. They all deal with civilians at war. And, in an armed conflict... Certainly in modern armed conflicts, most of the fatalities are in fact civilians.
Right.
So, I mean, the figures, I heard them on the radio not that long ago, 70% of the victims in war are civilians, not combatants. And particularly, of course, in a civil conflict. So I guess doctors were my way into the civilian population. They're the ones, the psychologists and the surgeons, who mainly deal with the civilian population.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I think at one point... I
was just fascinated as well. I mean, these things came across incrementally. You know, aging was in another book, and then what happened was I broke my Achilles tendon and had to go to a hospital in Sierra Leone. It's a shameful thing. I challenged somebody to a race on a beach. I didn't even do it in a heroic way. I broke my Achilles tendon and I had to go to hospital. I wasn't going to go to the state hospital because I knew, because my cousin had had to have an operation there and I'd had to help him out. He had shrapnel on his leg left over from the war, and he'd had to have the whole operation performed without anaesthesia.
Oh.
And the reason was that there were no working anaesthetists in Sierra Leone. They'd all been killed or fled. So I went to an NGO-run hospital, which was for war victims. I mean, it was shameful, but even as I sat there on my gurney waiting to be treated, I did think, God, this would make a great setting for a novel. And so I went back and I asked the doctors if they would, you know, if they would humour me and allow me to have a look around and spend time there. So I just began the research, and then when I got into the operating theatre, when I blagged my way into the operating theatre, I just thought, this is the place, you know, because absolute calm and control and order and egoless. And yet everything that was going on outside those walls was the complete opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because even though you read a lot about this trauma that the civilians are going through, one of the characters in the book, I think somebody mentions PTSD, and one character says, yes, but it's life. You know, it's life. This is what you go through. It's trauma. So I thought that was an interesting comment. Was it difficult switching from the three points of view, Kai and Adrian and Elias? Do you write in one point of view until you finish that storyline and go back?
No,
or do you switch back and forth?
Because the story was just too big, too labyrinthine.
Yeah.
So I write chronologically, mm-hmm. and I just go from one to the other to the other. Because what I'm trying to do is reverse the gaze, so typically, and particularly, I suppose, in novels set in Africa, we have one gaze, which is the Western gaze, we have had, because those are the countries the writers come from. But what I try to do is reverse the gaze. So, you know, Adrian looks at Kai, but Kai looks back at Adrian, and so we see,
yes.
we
mm-hmm.
see what Adrian doesn't understand or know, what mm-hmm. he does see, which of course is, at least he sees what is new to him a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we look back at Adrian with Kai's knowledge of what's happened in that country and the way he sees Adrian. So I flip them around like that. And with the relationship between Adrian and Elias, you know, Adrian is trying to get an understanding of what Elias is really about. At the point he begins to realise that there's more to this story than just a man using him as a, you know, as a therapist, as a free therapist, really, just sort of last recounting, he realises actually there is something about this story that requires understanding, and more than that, requires judgment.
Mm. It's interesting because he's trying to create a record, Elias is, of you know, that somehow absolves him. And this idea of leaving behind records, I think, is really relevant also in Ancestor Stones, because you write from the perspectives of four different women, but you really honored a tradition of oral storytelling in Ancestor Stones. Is that something that is very important to you?
I wouldn't say that it is very important to me, but it's just the fact of the way it is.
Or
most
it was.
I mean, interestingly, sort of still is in some ways, because Sierra Leone's literacy levels are extremely low.
Mm.
Before the war, they were only at 10% of functional literacy, meaning you could read a novel, a newspaper, not just a road sign. So, you know, actually a lot of people relate things
orally.
A lot of information is given orally.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I discovered, which is actually rather charming, is the way that my books are read a lot in Sierra Leone is through oral storytelling. It's sort of gone written. So somebody gets the book, a literate person gets the book, and they hold far side readings every night and read a chapter, and people come and listen to the stories.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, you may come in at chapter 5, you listen to it all the way around again. It's very charming. But, so, you know, Ancestor Stones is not the story of my family. Popularly it's supposed to be, but isn't. Those women don't exist.
I was going to ask you about that.
Gets
about
kind of
the assumptions around it, yeah.
But I did get the story of my family from my eldest aunt. And the way she told that story, she absolutely began with the words, "Your great-grandfather, Palmolive, was a warrior at the time of the Gabanka Wars." And this story just unspooled. And she was the last person in my family who could do that. Then come the literate generation. Actually, there's a very sad moment where literacy doesn't really take over, but the oral is lost. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of gap where the stories get lost. And then they move, at least in my family, more into people become more and more literate.
Mm-hmm. So I guess this might lead me into the next question. I remember that one. Ancestor Stones was published. A number of people thought that it was. Like, why?
It was very frustrating. Everyone thought it was my life. So, I mean, just because I came from Sierra Leone, and I thought, well, lots of people come from lots of countries and set stories in those countries. It doesn't mean that. And actually, my family took it awfully well, because some things weren't that flattering. Hmm. Everyone was going around thinking it was them. But, you know, I had a journalist in my house looking for two children that did not exist. She said, "When are the children back?" I said, "What children?" "So do you have two children?" I said, "I don't." She thought my husband was from Portugal. He's not. Then, of course, what happens is I do have a plantation in Sierra Leone. I do have a plantation in Sierra Leone. But I did lots of research on agriculture, and I helped my family village with charitable projects or social entrepreneurship. So I, having done loads of research on agriculture, I thought, what a good idea it would be if we grew cashew nuts, because that would be a cash crop for the village, you see. And then people could come in with their own little small holdings and we could, you know, generate an economy. So I started this social entrepreneur project, and I named it after the... I should have seen this coming. I named it after the fictional one in Ancestor Stones. I called it Khalifa Estates, because it was a sort of... And, of course, you know, this was life imitating art, not the other way around. But it is dutifully reported in every newspaper that I inherited a plantation in Sierra Leone. I wish.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for this. This was really lovely.
Thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.